listening to Syracuse University GradCast. Today I am very excited to introduce you to the inimitable and absolutely unique and wonderful Dr. Diane Wiener. She is a research professor and the associate director of interdisciplinary programs and outreach at Syracuse University's Burton Blatt Institute, that's located in the College of Law. And prior to that role, she was the founding director of the Syracuse University Disability Cultural Center. And even further prior, she was a social worker and an assistant professor at Binghamton University. I've known Diane practically since I got here, so that's somewhere around 7 years. And I know her as a lovely friend and a tireless advocate for people with disabilities and in general for those who are marginalized and who need a voice. And so when we decided that we wanted to talk a little bit about topics like this, it was very easy to choose Diane. And I am delighted with the result and with her insights, and I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation.
Diane, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, anything you'd like to share with our listeners?
Sure. Thanks very much for hosting this wonderful show, this podcast, and for having me join you on this wonderful, almost spring, we hope, afternoon. And my name's Diane Wiener. And I always tell the students, if you're ever feeling low or in a blue mood, any word you put before Wiener will bring you cheer. You know, you have my permission to do that. Any adjective, any noun, you know, it doesn't matter. Whatever the language, whatever the linguistic conventions, Wiener, W-I-E-N-E-R. That's my dad's fault. May he rest in power and peace. And I'm currently the Associate Director of Interdisciplinary Programs and Outreach and a research professor in the Burton Blatt Institute, which is a disability rights organizational approach toward global engagement of disabled people. Some people use, you know, identity first language, disabled people. Some folks prefer person first language, people with disabilities. I use both, and I respect whatever way people want to self-identify. And so my work has largely been to advance disability rights and to advance disability justice. My approach toward disability justice comes from the commitments of organizations like SINS and VALID. I have some materials here I'm happy to share, and we can maybe have some links for the graduate students and other participants and listeners and folks accessing the content otherwise, not just auditorily, assuming there's a transcript, I hope. And so, great. And so SINS and VALID's principles of disability justice inform the work that I do. And so in my current role, I have a number of different capacities. You know, we do event management. I'm the lead editor for one of the oldest disability cultural and literary journals in the country, in the unceded lands, known as the United States, quote unquote, the country, the nation state. The journal is called Word Gathering, a journal of disability poetry and literature, but it really also embraces the arts and what some people would call crip lit and crip arts. So I do all kinds of educational programs and symposia and conferences and engage across campus, across the schools and colleges. And I run the journal, and I also mentor and supervise a number of students in different programs, including at Falk College, who were placed in internships on campus as a social worker, because I also have an MSW. And what else can I say about myself? I always want to check about my pacing and volume, and how's that right now?
I think pretty good.
Great. So yesterday, your colleague and our friend and colleague, Glenn Wright, invited me yet again to be a workshop facilitator for the Future Professoriate Programs Certificate in University Teaching series. And as part of that, I talked a little bit about, you know, the concepts of disability justice as they relate to universal design for learning, which is something I'll talk about a little bit later when you're asking me different things. And so my approach toward universal design is informed by a commitment to disability justice, framed by, I think, a conceptual framework that is born out of design justice. And so that's a little bit about who I am. I'm also a in attempting to be a musician. I am also a writer in multiple genres. And the most important thing is, I think there's a big difference between ego and confidence, and I aim for the latter and not the former. And so I'm very honored to be here without hubris and with gratitude.
Diane, thank you so much. I love that introduction. We got to see all different facets of you and your work, which there are plenty, and we're lucky to have you here. So thank you again.
Thank you.
And I wanted to get started by just asking you, so we're talking about soft skills and career competencies that the world needs and wants. And these ones are based on employers. And so we work in the space, Dan and I, of career. And a lot of employers are focused on equity and inclusion. So first off, can you give us a definition or an explanation of what is equity?
I think that my understanding of equity is born largely out of having been the founding director of our Disability Cultural Center, because in the context of thinking of equity as connected with diversity and inclusion and belonging and accessibility, because I think of them all together in relationship to one another and as interconnected, the idea of equity is to understand things being egalitarian and fair and at a so-called level playing field, whether it's baseball or some other arena. I guess that was a double pun. I didn't mean it, but okay. And there's something about the idea of equity that I think is often misapprehended, I think, as being about making up for something that wasn't done right in the first place. And I think that the reason I think that's a misapprehension is that whenever there's a commitment to make things equitable that hadn't been equitable, or to make things equal when they hadn't been equal, the failing is not in the remediation and the need to remediate or adapt or update or improve or make right and civic and ethical. The failing is in that has to be done in the first place. So we shouldn't need an affirmative action law. We shouldn't need the Americans with Disabilities Act. We shouldn't need 504. We shouldn't need 508. We shouldn't need a number of these different Title IX and Title VI and other kinds of laws and regulations and protocols, but we sure do need them, and we must honor them. And they all are committed variously and in overlapping ways to this concept of equity, which is to make equal what often is not. And so what is equity in and of itself? It's the idea of a real down-to-earth engagement with fairness, and that everyone has the same access to the same opportunities: employment, education, engagement in the world, athletics, the arts, the humanities, the sciences, the world of imagination, whatever the arenas might be, to use that word again, that's what equity means to me. And inclusion is an effort to make sure that the process of equity is realized on the ground, as it were, by assuring that everyone from every possible axis of difference and the intersections of axes of difference is in fact included. And then again, unfortunately, has to be an effort, because the world is often not equitable. And so the orientation towards inclusion is to assure that people are welcomed and invited when it ought to have just been that way in the first place. And these are my opinions, which I'm not going to hide.
That's why you're here. We didn't want you to hide.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great. I think that was incredibly helpful. And I think one of the major things that you touched on as well is that these things should be there already, but it's hard for people sometimes to understand, well, this is the way I do it. This doesn't mean this is the way that everybody can, should, has to. And so bringing, like you said, these laws into play are to protect people, because these things still happen where things are not equitable. And that's huge. It's so important. And, you know, so knowing that, how do we, you know, especially from our different privileges, you know, how do we continuously improve our skills in learning about equity and inclusion, especially when we do have some identities that are privileged, maybe some identities that are not? What can we do? Where should we start?
I love that the way you asked that. And I think one of the things that's important to me is to understand what I think is a commitment as it's, I think it's foundational to the way I think and the way I understand myself in the world. I believe in simultaneous truths. And I think that the current historical moment, I guess, is that there's a wokeness, which was not as respected. It did not exist before, but it wasn't as respected around vigilant discrimination and vigilant toxic treatment of other people. And that now there is a more commonplace understanding of how, in fact, deeply inequitable and socially violent systems and interpersonal communication tend to be in a world that's localized around power dynamics in places like this unceded land. And so what we need to do is to realize the we isn't one we, and that even though obviously I believe that humanity is a one we, that the disaggregated power dynamics that are true and not made up at all, that are underneath every single dynamic that goes back decades and hundreds of thousands of years in multiple spaces is alive today in a way that we need to take seriously. And so to not wax too polemical, but the term gaslighting, I think, has been really instructive for multiple generations as a way to talk about the problem with decades and eons of invalidation. And one of the ways I think to continuously improve our skills in these areas is to take accountability and ownership over our own misapprehensions and assumptions. So first is that the we of humanity is a we, but that everyone in that we is not treated equally. And to advance equity and inclusion is to have to stick yourself in a position where, or put yourself in a position, I think I'd edit that, where you're committed always to what is a tiring effort at making sure that people are treated as they deserve to be treated. And again, it shouldn't be tiring, but it is. And those people among different populations who are already situated because of oppression and disenfranchisement and marginalization and inequity, to be more likely to be exhausted because those of us in those groups are already called upon to educate oppressors about oppression, have to be honored in what many people refer to as mutual aid. You know, so it's a gigantic question you're asking me. It's sort of the cornerstone of my career and of my life, actually. And so, you know, what does it mean? I mean, Audre Lorde famously asked, you know, what could we do with all the energy we're spending or expending educating oppressors about what it's like to be oppressed? If we didn't have to do that, what could we do instead? Imagine what could be done instead. So, you know, I'm a white Ashkenazi Jew. I have advanced degrees that I earned in a traditional academic environment. I'm also someone who holds a multiplicity of marginalized identities. And so I'm one of many people who's simultaneously marginalized and very privileged. And so I have to own that and live with that and not apologize for that, but be accountable for that every minute of my professional and personal lives. That's one way to advance change, is that each person does that. And I do think it's important when we think about institutions like Syracuse University, which are, as many institutions of higher education are, a predominantly white institutional space, a PWI, and a place where what Jay Dolmage and others refer to as replete with academic ableism and other patterns which people fight against, but they're endemic and entrenched and built that way. The spaces are built that way. Then in order to and continuously improve, we have to be supportive of each other around the inequity and combating it in a I think a pacifist but assertive way. And I think that we have to be in solidarity with each other, acknowledging our differences and overlaps and commitments So I hope that wasn't too long-winded.
I mean, you have so much information to share. So I think kind of acknowledging who we are, our identities, understanding we participate in all of these different systems is definitely a first step for sure. And I think that can be hard for a lot of people to do, but I think obviously, as you know, and as you said, it has to happen. Otherwise, you're not aware and you're not able to take the next step to educate yourself, to make changes, to be inclusive, to be equitable. And that's something that, as you mentioned, is exhausting for the people who are disenfranchised. And so when people who come with certain privileges also say, why do we have to do this? Well, we should all be exhausted by it, because
yes,
we as the collective, we, as you mentioned, need to be there for each other and to stand in solidarity. And so I think that answer was wonderful and gives us so much to think about.
And you mentioned
a few people, Audre Lorde, other people whose work we should be looking into if, you know, someone is just starting on this journey or doesn't know where to turn to next.
I think that would take a long time to answer, but I'll give you my short answer.
Yeah, your short list, yeah.
I recently mentioned earlier in the conversation my gratitude for and devotion to Sins Invalid, and I actually have this next to me because I wanted to tell everyone about it who may not be familiar. This is a disability justice primer by Sins Invalid. It's the second edition. It's called Skin, Tooth, and Bone: The Basis of Movement is Our People. It includes an image description of the cover. It's available in digital format, accessibly, of course. And the orientation here is one that really helps to go deeply into thinking about what does solidarity mean? What does accessibility mean? How do we think about the concept of intersectionality, which we owe very much to Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined it in 1989. And also concepts of intersectionality are much older than that, although they weren't called that. And so Dr. Paulie Murray, who was an Episcopal reverend and a leader in gender equity and racial equity and equity around sexual expression, when Paulie was alive, decades ago, there wasn't yet a trans rights movement. And so it's interesting to think about intersectionality and gratitude for the Reverend Dr. Paulie Murray, and how there are people, to whom Dr. Crenshaw is grateful, I believe, including Dr. and Reverend Dr. Murray, whose work I think people could read to learn a lot about the origins of the concepts of intersectional identities and axes of difference. So this is, a disability justice framework starts from a perspective of intersectionality. And the second major principle of the principles, which are 10, is leadership of those most impacted. So I'm going to read this brief little bit here on page 23 of this particular guide, but in the digital format, it's online, of course, so it's not the same pagination structure. Leadership of those most impacted. When we talk about ableism, racism, sexism, and transmisogyny, colonization, police violence, etc., we are not looking to academics and experts to tell us what's what. We are lifting up, listening to, reading, following, and highlighting the perspectives of those who are most impacted by the systems we fight against. By centering the leadership of those most impacted, we keep ourselves grounded in real-world problems and find creative strategies for resistance. And so the role of academics is to be an allyship and accompliceship with folks in those other spaces. However, it's also the case that we have many people who would identify as being activist scholars or people who are occupying, and I don't mean in a settler colonial way, occupying multiple identities in multiple spaces. So I think there's a lot to be done to think about allyship and accompliceship in working in solidarity with people instead of this. Maybe a town gown split is often called, right? So the university exists on the hill in the context of a local community, and the people who live in the local community don't necessarily feel very welcomed at the higher educational landscape, literally and figuratively or symbolically. What does it mean to undermine the town-gown split and have a real collaborative effort that centers the experience of those most impacted in a city like Syracuse, for example?
Thank you for sharing that, and that passage, I think, is incredibly important.
Diane, what do you wish people knew about equity and inclusion that they either misunderstand or just simply don't know or don't get?
I guess one thing that I think about a lot, Dan, is that I think that there are still some folks who perceive that there's a kind of almost like a entitlement element to advancing social change that is not, in fact, I don't think I have the right answer per se, but I think that the argument that this things are backwards now and it's all upside down and the people who were marginalized are now becoming centered in a way that didn't exist before. It's like an appeal to a form of social Darwinism, almost eugenical in its approach toward thinking of equity from the other direction, which is to undermine advances and to keep things as a status quo. And so I wish, sad to say, I wish more people knew how many people actually feel that way. And, you know, those of us who feel rather differently labeled as snowflakes, et cetera, for wanting to have a more equitable world. I really wish more people knew that and fought against that orientation and were aware that though not everyone can fight that orientation because it isn't safe for them because their very lives might be at stake. So there's, I think, a lot of judgment about what activism means and what change means and what allyship means and what accomplishment means and what does it mean to advance change, because not everybody has the same access to be able to do that. Literally, some places of engagement are not accessible to everybody. The language isn't accessible. The space isn't accessible. The digital interface isn't accessible. The conversational style isn't accessible. There isn't enough pause time. There isn't a sensitivity to what it means to think of different learning styles, if I didn't already say that. And so I want to first think about what it means to face the music, not just auditorily. What does it mean to actually acknowledge how many people don't want there to be equity? And what do we do about that? And again, who is we? Who are we? And the second layer is not everybody has the same access to making that influx of change, but also it isn't appropriate to expect everyone to participate in the same way because it may be violent or dangerous to people in a way that impacts their lives in an unequal manner. I don't think a lot of people, even in the worlds of equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, think about disability as part of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, and that accessibility is often understood as about disability, but not about economics, and not about language, and not about a number of other arenas, again, to use that word for the third time, maybe the fourth, because diversity is part of the conversation always around these, you know, academic spaces and landscapes and networks. But disability is an afterthought if it's thought of at all. And I think that one of the reasons that I'm perceived as not everyone's favorite person to talk with about this is because I will relentlessly talk about disability as being part of diversity. And it has to be always part of the conversations and actions about diversity. Conversations are actions, of course, in part. And I don't just mean verbal conversations, and I don't just mean textual conversation. I'm also talking about pictorial conversations, which should have all text, and sign language and conversations, and numbers of ways that people type to communicate, et cetera. So what I think one of the biggest lessons is that I wish people knew about equity and inclusion is that conversations about equity and inclusion, even in places that are expertise based on equity and inclusion, don't include disability enough and need to more and always.
One thing that occurs to me, and it goes back really to the conversation that you and Tracy, Diane, were having earlier, is about, you know, difficulty and what's hard and for whom should it be hard. And I think one of the things that I hear in what you're saying is about the different ways that accessibility impacts people with disabilities is that, you know, we talk about what difficult things we have to do as people who occupy some spaces where we might have disabilities and others where maybe we're not, is that it's already hard for those people. You know, if we're putting in the time and doing something difficult, that's fine. There are other people who are already experiencing difficulty, and why shouldn't we equalize that effort?
I think one of the things that really intrigues me about the the new tendencies in the corporate sector, in the non-for-profit sector, in higher education, in social services, across the entrepreneurial, you know, realm, in every single sector of career and employment, is this conversation about DEI or sometimes DEIA that still, again, doesn't necessarily include disability when, in fact, disability is arguably, as some people would say or articulate otherwise, the largest marginalized group in any place, arguably transtemporally and cross-culturally, even, not sure I want to say it like that, but so one of the things I'm interested in thinking about and doing something about is, if we think about disability as part of diversity and have a commitment to intersectionality as central to any efforts at advancing social change born out by equity as a real experience for people, not just in writing or, you know, that it actually occurs, that we don't still have people fighting for equitable pay. And I think that there are ways that we can talk about disability as part of diversity that are different than some of the ways it's often discussed now. So I always quote Neil Marcus over and over, and he famously said, disability is an ingenious way to live. And when he said, disability is an ingenious way to live, I believe what he meant, I don't know for sure, but I believe what he meant, and my interpretation is that oftentimes disability is an experience that people have, of course, quite variously. And those of us who identify as disabled, and I certainly do, find ways to manage in a world that wasn't built for us, that wasn't made with us in mind, that was in fact designed to exclude us, that was set up in ways not because of some conspiracy, but because of an effort to really create hierarchy to keep certain people inside and keep certain people outside, and to eliminate certain levels of engagement because of a belief in a certain superior way of being, which is the superior way of being is to not be disabled. And that's what ableism is. Ableism is the belief that disabled people are inferior and do not have the same status and can't and should not have the same status as non-disabled people, including people with so-called hidden disabilities. And hidden disabilities or non-apparent disabilities, sometimes called invisible disabilities, which still in fact privileges visuality, so it's not just about visibility, that people with those disabilities are differently not to be welcomed than the people with the so-called obvious disabilities. So one of the things that interests me about how disturbing this is that Neil Marcus is highlighting that you have to figure out how to manage creatively in a world like that. However, I think he's also saying, in a much more interesting and much more meaningful way, frankly, what Steve Cousisteau and I talk about this all the time, the life of the imagination. Many people talk about this, of course. So, you know, the imagination that accompanies what it means to live in a disabled life and what it means to live a disabled life, the kind of imagination someone has to have or could have is something that can't be colonized, however hard some others may try. And so the ingenuity isn't just a coping mechanism or a strategy for survival. It's part of a different way of being in the world than when someone is not disabled, which is not to say that all disabled people are the same, because I would never say that and certainly don't think that. So that's really interesting and important and meaningful to me, Neil Marcus's assertion. And so the principle that underscores that is relevant, I think, to non-disabled people. And in the context of COVID-19, I think a lot of things that disabled people have known for decades and decades are now becoming clearer to a lot of non-disabled people. And without being too negative or jaded about it, I think it's unfortunate that it took a pandemic for the non-disabled people to realize how much they benefited from learning from disabled people. And I hope that when the pandemic is less egregiously affecting and harmful, that the non-disabled people will not forget what they learned from the disabled people, which in fact help them manage those of them or those of us who feel that way.
You talked earlier about hidden or invisible disabilities or identities. And of course, people with or people who have hidden disabilities, identities, invisible, whatever you want to call them, are in workplaces all over the world in innumerable positions. And they present, obviously, as many different challenges as those people who possess them. So what advice would you have for individuals who are in workplaces and experiencing the difficulties that come from people not recognizing what disabilities they may have?
I think that part of the complexity and nuance here is that people are not, of course, legally obligated to disclose disabilities. And it is not ethical or legal to require to someone to disclose a disability. But if somebody does disclose a disability, then what's to be done to make sure, if the person wants and needs and requires, obviously, to have accommodation, what is the responsibility of the employer to that individual? And so one of the ways I think this is extremely relevant to career services and to students and others and constituents across higher education who are seeking opportunities and seeking to, you know, embolden themselves, advance their careers, change a career, whatever they're trying to do in a career services pathway, you know, should I put on my resume or on my curriculum vitae that I have a disability? Should, if there's a gap in my, employment history because of a disability-related reason, do I tell people that? We can say that we want to live in an equitable world, but if I say that, I'm saying this on behalf of, with respect, this other person, right? Although I've thought that myself about sometimes in my life, I'll say too. But, you know, what does it mean to have to ask questions like that? And how do you coach someone as a career advisor and an expert in career services to think through a question like that? Because unfortunately, the pragmatic reality is, even though we want to, to live in an equitable world, there are ways in which somebody will often be discriminated against because of a gap on their resume, if it's around a disability-related reason, or because of some other disability-connected explanation. And so I think that it's not naive, but it's not ideal to pretend that's not true. So I think there's got to be a way. I'll go into full-blown Brooklyn. There's got to be a way. There's got to be a way to help people think about this critically and strategically and in a nuanced way that is very dependent on the context, the job site, the interviewing process, where, frankly, what part of the region someone's working in, what their role is. I mean, a million things. So it's not just like, don't ever say that, or definitely say that, or definitely think about when you want to say. It's very complicated. And so I think that, you know, people with hidden and invisible disabilities are more frequently the populations of people with disabilities in the workplace. But that's partly because of ableism, again, that people with not hidden disabilities are less likely to be hired in the first place. And the unemployment and underemployment rate for folks with disabilities in the United States, aka the unceded land, or I should say it the other way around, the unceded land known as the United States by some, is that percentage is enormously high still, even in the third decade of the 21st century. And it's not just because of COVID at all. It's because of ableism and because of other forms of discrimination. And so, you know, the work that disabled people are doing to advance employability of one another through numerous initiatives and nonprofit sector advocacy efforts, and also through organizations and enterprises like Disability IN, which has a really powerful model that encourages organizations to sign on to show they have buy-in, as it were, that, you know, we want to hire disabled people. We welcome disabled people. We believe that disabled employees strengthen the organization. We believe that being disabled in the context of an organizational culture makes the organizational culture stronger, more robust, more ingenious, going back to Neil Marcus, but not just born out of necessity, born out of imagination. I hope I answered your question.
I think you answered my question and possibly several that I didn't anticipate.
Yes, I sit accused and I don't mind.
Diane, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. I think this is so important and it's such a major part of who we are as human beings and who we are as human beings at work and in connection to each other. And I hope that this gives our listeners some things to think over. And things that Diane has referenced here will be included along with the link for the GradCast episode itself. So I hope that you'll be able to peruse those. And Diane Wiener, thank you very much for being a part of Syracuse University GradCast today.
It was my delight and a privilege and an honor. Thanks for inviting me to be with you. May the Schwartz be with you, as we say on the retelecasting of Spaceballs, the movie. And I am happy to answer any questions anyone who tunes in or accesses the transcript might have. And I can be reached at dwiener, D-W-I-E-N-E-R, at syr.edu. And if anybody would like to reach out to me as it relates to Word Gathering, the journal I mentioned earlier, Word Gathering's email address is wordgathering, WORDGATHERING, at syr.edu. And those resources will also be shared among the others I'll give you to share with everyone. So thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
This has been Syracuse University GradCast. Have a good day. Mm-hmm.